Well, welcome everyone to another episode of Notes from the Aleph. An Aleph is a high point from which all things are visible, and from our vantage point, we'll be looking at tabletop role-playing games, their design, and the theory behind those designs. Around here, our motto is be fair, build up, and have fun. I'm your host, Griffin Bro, joined by our editor, Theta, our local designer, Norman Rafferty, our good friend and GM, Red Rabbit, and local kiddie pool enthusiast, Lessons Learned. When it comes to tabletop games, I have 15 years of experience running, playing, and frequently fixing problematic rule sets at the table. Pronouns are he, him, they, them. Lessons, why don't you go next?
Yes, Lessons Learned. Lessons Learned 1 on Twitch, Lessons Learned on YouTube. I go by he, him. Been running games for well over 30 years, mostly Dungeons & Dragons with many other systems, many, many other systems. I also run the Sunday game here on Raptor's channel, Greyhawk Into the Wild Coast, 5th edition D&D, and budding game designer and author, which I have my works over at Amazon, Night and Stars for 99 cents.
All right, Red.
Okay, I'm Red Rabbit, he, him. I'm running our Wednesday game of Ironclaw here on the channel. I like to dabble in a lot of different kinds of RPGs. I'm currently on a bit of an OSR quest to find the old school revival game of my dream, but I also consider myself a student of narrative and of game design.
Last but not least, Norman Rafferty.
Hello, world. I'm Norman Rafferty, he, him. I work for Sanguine Games. You may recognize me from such venues as MAGFest 2022. I'm back in the saddle. Lot of stuff to do.
All right. So for today's topic, have you guys ever gotten a sneaking suspicion that a monster you've been wailing on has too many hit points? Or maybe you've asked your GM for your character have a special ability because it's a part of their cool backstory, or just perhaps the GM just rolled something behind the screen, nodded, and said, yeah, I guess that worked. Well, then you, my friend, have encountered cheating. Unlike any other type of cheating, this is the sort of benign form where the goal is usually to make playing the game more fun or interesting, not to ruin it for everyone and make sure you win. Lots of rulebooks even encourage GMs to break the rules for any reason whatsoever, and even explicitly stated out the gate. So here today, we want to ask, so when do we break these rules? Why? And what kind of outcomes do we see from this behavior? And should we keep doing it? So that's where we're going to start off today. Who'd like to take that one?
Yep, I'd like to take that one, because this has a lot of things in it, including play as, you know, Yes, that's the take. Also, you know, rolling die in front or behind the screen and fudging dice, etc. And, you know, just, oh, the rules are there, but you can make your own house rules, pack, whatever. So I think this basically boils down to spirit versus, you know, written rules, right? If you go into the spirit of the rules, right, more performative play, then sure, fudging dice and rolling behind the screen, because it's about the fun, right? It's all about keeping the game going, and you don't want anybody to be upset, and you want things to be challenging, but not, you know, TPK, or you want that character, that player to feel special, because they're the ones who always show up to the table, no matter what, and so, you know, why not give them that extra little attention? But on the other hand, it's like, well, you know, the expectation of you're always going to fudge the rules, so we're never going to really have a real challenge, whether it's combat or anything else. And also, well, if I really, really pound my GM for special rules, that he will always, you know, do whatever I want him to do. And so my character will be extra cool because, of course, they'll have the special, you know, flying, you know, reverse unicorn that can, you know, should fire rainbows up their butt. So it doesn't really matter, right? It's always the thing that you want. And it's all a matter of, I think, the conversation of how far you're willing to push it without breaking the ongoing conversation, the group dynamic, right? I'm more of the, you know, we got to have some, you know, rules and follow them. That's why they're there. But I'm not completely opposed to, you know, changing things if they need to be changed, mostly because there's no perfect rule set except Ironclaw. And therefore, you know, just plug it in there. And therefore, you have to, you know, make adjustments. So at the very least, I never really believe in raw as, you know, rules as written 100%, because there's always that one space, either because people misinterpret the rules, don't understand them, or simply the rules don't call for it. So you have to, at the very least, fill in that space. And that's when you get into the, well, let's fudge things.
I would agree on one level, because I think I'm ultimately going to take the other side of this argument, but to your point, I think it's a very good point that these games are social exercises and that humanity is complex and messy, and there's no one rule set that will ensure that everyone sitting around the table is always going to have a good time 100% of the time without any thought or adjustment, right? So to that degree, I think I definitely agree with what you're saying, Lessons.
Yeah, I mean, like, the core thesis of any of this is that if you're sitting down to play a game for 4 hours with five people, you should probably be having fun doing it. So that's always should be the goal. But everyone would know that me, Rafferty, and Theta are, like, heavy sticklers for how the rules are written and making sure they're executed properly. But the first thing you hit upon was, like, adversity lessons. Which is that, well, you know, if we want to have a narrative, the players need adversity. If they don't have adversity, they don't overcome anything, and it's not really a narrative. They just went to the store and got their groceries. I mean, that's not exactly thrilling or engaging or even an interesting story most of the time, unless something happens and they have to go do something about it. But there's like a line between saying, well, you've hit him 3 times and he should be dead. I'm going to just not tell you that he should be dead, and you're going to have to hit him for 4 hits. But you're the GM. You're the arbiter of the universe. You can just say, well, and then a second one steps in. Where from? I don't know. There's no rule saying I can't do that either. You get the same kind of effectiveness because the same goal is there. You thought the challenge needs more to be overcome in the heat of the moment. And so that's like a creation process on the GM part. I think you were about to say something, Rafferty, right?
Well, I mean, like, I think going back at some of our earlier sessions here and doing the, because it's not that there's a lack of rule. Like, I know a lot of times we talk about formalism, the idea that rules is written, you are here to execute a game, like it's some sort of chess match. And then, of course, there's also performative play that we often see on stuff like Critical Role, where, you know, people are hamming up the cameras. But I've been asserting that the Mercer effect that people are worried about is it's not that the people who are doing a performative game don't have rules. They do. They just have a different set of rules than what a role-playing game would have. I mean, we assert before we start here, be fair, build up, and have fun. The rule behind any good streamed game is be entertaining. And then to be entertaining, you have to look good, no dead air, improv. Those are all rules. And the reason why we talk about some of these other performative games is because they meet those rules. If they weren't entertaining, or if they were engaging in behavior that people dislike, I'm not going to drop any names here, you know, they wouldn't be popular. They would be failing by the rules, and players would quit, and people would stop watching. So right. when we're talking about cheating here, we're talking about where, you know, if the book had a bunch of rules in it, and, you know, and we were following them, when do we break those? And the real problem here is the rules are what make sense. Like, if you showed up at a D&D game and people weren't playing dwarves and elves and killing monsters, you would probably be confused about what was going on. It wouldn't make sense. If your GM, you know, decided every attack excites opportunity, not just ranged attacks, you'd get confused.
Right.
And you know, like suddenly things would change. Or they decide to use a fumble rule. That's a popular one that shows up a lot. Like, you'd say, well, if you play a fumble rule, my fighter is screwed. But, you know, but in other words, those are the dimensions. So when someone is cheating, when someone's breaking the rules, things are making less sense. It's like, this was less of me reading a rule book and trying to understand the universe by reading the rule book, and more like, you're just, as the GM, you're just going to do whatever the heck you want. So I should be trying to figure out what you want, and the rules are secondary to all of that.
Right. Yeah. If we want to get like hyper abstract here, it's like all these rules are constructions that we agree to. And if we've all agreed to a set of rules, we should keep to them. And if we haven't, then we have a problem. But I think like a more common like way of breaking the rules is, like you said, we break them because it makes more sense. Every D20 game has like a list of like, well, here's what happens at DC 10, 15, and 20 when you roll different skills. And I can guarantee 90% of the time when you're running a game and someone says they want to roll skill for something you didn't really anticipate, you don't go back to the chart and specifically look up everything. You usually go, well, it's a little bit hard. I'm making it 15. Well, you really shouldn't be doing it. It's 25. And you do it because it makes sense, because that's how it kind of feels right, and it's what the players are expecting too. And that's also a way to inform them of what you think that should be doing.
Yeah, I think also, especially when you talk about Griffin, it's, you talk about consistency, right?
Yes.
In other words, it and we'll talk about how things are fair in another episode. It doesn't feel fair when one rule is applied one way and then changes, whether it's a rule on the book or a house rule or a hack. And it's like, oh, but you said to that player that if they roll a 15 or higher on this, they would get it. But I rolled a 25 and I'm not getting it, right? Or, you know, if I fall off a cliff, I take X amount of damage, but this other person just fell up and they survived, right? It's like, why, right? Even cheating for the purpose of actually helping the players can also feel bad. I remember one scenario where the GM described this killer gas that was killing everybody, right? So my player went one way and tried to escape, couldn't escape. And so when he turned back, it was like, okay, I got to go through this gas. It's going to be like 5 or 10 saving throws. I'm not going to make it. Yeah, my character dies. And my GM was like, would you want to die? You shouldn't do that. You know, you should, you know, he was so angry with me because I didn't follow the rules that he said. He literally had an NPC just melt before my eyes when this deadly guy hit him. I was like, I don't want to go in there. Right. And the other option was dropping into a, you know, into a, you know, open pit that we had to get up through, you know, some ridiculous way. And it was like, he was so mad that I didn't do the thing that Jeopardy said, what the GM was expecting me to do.
He didn't He expected you to intuit his moon logic on this.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you brought that up because there's often me, the GM, who I want to charitably say is bad at math. They wanted to present what they thought was an adversarial situation, but they didn't realize that the players would interpret it badly. So now they're trying to backpedal on it. Like they said something that mechanically, like you said, 5 saving throws to get to the end of this. You know, and you're sitting there going, well, I don't want my character to die. That is an unacceptable risk for the reward, you know, and it's also not an interesting challenge. Making 5 die rolls to avoid dying is not interesting. So, you know, you're not going to do it. But the GM is now in a bind because they want you to do it, but they wanted you to feel challenged, but didn't communicate that. So now the GM is in a position where they might want to cheat. And they might want to, because I've had that happen before where GM backpedals on this. They say, okay, well, I know I said it does, you know, like save versus death or die, but you didn't actually die when you were hit. And I'm sympathetic to that because, like, you know, GM, not everybody's good at rules. That's why we bought a book. But it's a poor showing because it makes the GM lose, you know, they lose player confidence because now, once again, confusion. We as the players were told something incredibly deadly, but now we're told that it's not. So now we don't know what threats are anymore, and we lose investiture in the narrative. And once again, not a problem if it's a performative game, because performative players just do what they're told. And so, you know, this wouldn't be a problem in that sort of game. This is a problem in the sort of formal game where we expect rules to be consistent.
Yeah, although I think the story also demonstrates a little bit more, because to what people might call the role-playing weasel, or the role-playing terrorist, which will be its own episode. But it also included, just for sex, more like 100 or 200 foot drop. So my character had to run through all this gas, then jump into the void, right, to save themselves. And then the GM's like, well, I would never kill your character. It's like, but I expect my character to die in this situation. I expect any character to. That's the rules, right? Otherwise, it's a situation where you're like, I'm okay with my character dying. You're the one who has a problem with my character dying because you made the miscalculation. I have no problem. I realize the character's going to die.
Yeah, and you're so angry. Premise that people should. It's funny because it's not taken for granted in a lot of modern D&D settings and a lot of games. I mean, and there's games out there that don't have death as part of the equation at all, which is fine. But it's funny because it's always been a part of the whole adventuring lifestyle is the threat of death, but the reality of that happening for some people seems anathema, which is interesting.
It's a huge problem. Like I've been complaining about D&D, especially the 5th edition, because if you play rules as written, the game is ridiculously deadly. You show up with like 6 to 10 hit points, and there's monsters at first level that can do 2d6 damage easily. Or, you know, 6 kobolds each doing, because Dex adds the damage now, 6 kobolds each doing like 1d6 plus 3, or 5 hits each. They could literally kill you in a single hit if they roll high enough. There's also the idea of, well, no, but you spent 5 hours making your special character and describing every aspect of their being and choosing all these thoughts, hopes, and dreams. We're not supposed to kill you casually. And that sets, you know, because that's something I've complained before. The good GM wouldn't make this challenging. And so now you've got a problem where the GM is presented with materials that say, this encounter is this deadly. And then the GM might just say out loud, okay, you take 7 points of damage. And the wizard says, that kills me instantly. I was like, what do you mean? I thought you had 6 hit points. I had 6 hit points. I only have 1. That takes me past negative hit points. I'm dead. And suddenly they'll say, well, you're not dead. We'll come up. I'll find some way to break the rules to res you, even though I would have to jump through a huge amount of hoops to do this. And I mean, I feel bad because it's like people saying, well, that's not bad GM. No, but it can lead to problems later where the players are just confused. They were told the game was deadly, but now they know it's not.
Yeah.
And maybe if it was communicated like ahead of time, like, hey, guys, you know, I don't intend anything terrible to happen. We're just here having fun. Or you just lay down the law and goes like, I will murder your character and I do not care. At least then they know what to expect.
See, but this is why I was down on
between them.
I was down on session zero, if you remember our stream on that, because I don't think people ask or answer the correct questions. Like, I don't think in session, in the pre-planning stages, people explain, we're going to play D&D the old school way and the way it's written, which is we're going to freaking kill you, you know, so you need to pick your battles, which is something you have to, like, tell most modern players. They don't know that. They assume if they get killed, they can just get rest. Or you're going to run a more modern, you know, performative fun game where you want characters to encourage them to walk into doorways so they can emerge the other side naked and gender swapped. You know, like if you're going to have a more fun madcap game. And I don't think, you know, like that the session zero is setting up the rules. If you set up in the session zero that we're going to be looser and more fluid and more fun with the game, that's not the same thing as what we're talking about cheating, when the GM has to break the rules to make it work the way they think it's going to go. That's different from breaking rules that we agreed we would use, but I'm breaking it right now, as opposed to we already set up in advance, we're going to do some house ruling stuff.
Right. It's the communication and consistency that's always key in these situations. So you can always cheat, just let people know, like, yeah, you'll probably do it because you're interested in letting them have more fun, right?
I think the one rule that, and this, I'm getting ahead of myself, I guess, but the one rule you cannot break is the rule of the conversation, if you will, right? That this agreement we're just talking about, all the players have, including the GM, of what is beyond the bounds, whatever that may be, right? Every group is going to be different. Every game system, even playing the same game system, they'll have different takes on it. But one rule you're not supposed to break is that rule of trust, right? We said this was going to happen. You have, even if you have to, you got to have a good reason for it, right? And explain it. Sometimes even ahead of time, it's like, guys, I know we agree on this, but, you know, this is the situation and this is what's going to happen, you know?
Hey, guys, I know combat's really deadly in this game. So at first level, I'm just going to give you guys an extra 30 hit points. So this way you can do more than one fight in the entire adventure and we have a longer session.
I mean, Yeah. One of the house rules.
You can do stuff like that.
Uninformal rules that a lot of D&D players do around the fact that there's a levels 1 to 3 is that they're level 3, which actually is a rule that came from Dark Sun of all places. So it's like, hey, you start at level 3 because level 3, that's where you start getting your cool good stuff. Spells, you got a good hit point pool, and you start getting all the good stuff. So now you're an adventurer, right? Now you have a history. Now your background fits those 3 a year or 6 months, whatever those 3 the first levels, you know. Or some people actually do it where they start at level 0 characters, right? And then if they survive, then they become adventurers at level 1. So they actually role play their background. But again, that has to be agreed by the group. Otherwise, you know, if you come in and it's like, it's level 3, but I thought we started level 1. And I wanted to, you know, chart my complete thing, which I know people will actually do that. When I chart for level 1 all the way, and some people was like, level 0, but I want to throw fireballs. That means I got to wait another 20 hours to, if I survive, throw fireballs. So what, you know?
Well, one thing that we're kind of glossing over here, or we haven't brought up yet, is getting into the confusion of performative versus formal. There's another kind of cheating that most people wouldn't call this cheating, but that's where the published adventure or the GM or both, I say the same thing. That's another argument. But, want to do something in the story that's like patently impossible. Or contradicted by story elements or rules elements, but the GM really wants to tell this story so bad. So they break the rules. You often see this in some published adventures in the dreaded boxed text, where like suddenly the princess comes in the room with 20 of her warg warriors and they all surround you, blocking all of the exits. what's this here? And of course, like, you couldn't read all that in a box. The players would lose it. Like any, if you have like four players, one of them is going to go nuts saying, you never told us about the exits. You never told, like, how did 20 wolf warriors sneak up on us? You know, don't we get passive perception for that? And also, you know, in their favor, like, sometimes people say, well, if they're just rules lawyers, remember, you'll have 4 to 6 players who every time they leveled up made conscious choices. This is the thing that always bothers me about cheating is, like, in old school games, abilities were assigned random and you had to scavenge for them. Today, you have intelligent design. If a player, when they leveled up, specifically chose the ranger who gets anti-surprise bonuses, and then later you cheat to keep those surprise bonus anti-surprise from working, you have devastated that player's confidence because they looked at a bunch of choices, picked one they thought would have meaning, and you broke the rules to destroy it.
Right, and that's like a very frequent, like, change of rules at the table, but that's usually like a very audible one and less cheating and more just, I don't like what I just saw there, so I'm changing the rules now. Mm-hmm. Cheating, though, I guess would be more quietly undercutting, not letting the player do it without explicitly saying anything at the table, more insidious and terrible.
I suppose it would be cheating if they equivocated and just said, well, these are stealthy war, or just added abilities, afterwards. Well, I'm getting to the idea of, like, rules are supposed to, like, encourage your understanding. If the GM is assumed to have fiat that they can change any rule that they want and just change everything, then, you know, like, this is something I've constantly complained about where players are checking out. Like, yeah. I'm always complaining, there's no point trying to solve a mystery in D&D. Any monster can do anything. So you can just say a wizard did it or a monster did it and we're done. I don't care why anything happens in D&D because it just happens. And so if you're, you know, if we're playing the kind of game where I know the GM will just, these are golems that can disguise themselves and teleport. It's like, okay. But I mean, you know, I will have checked out at that point because it's kind of like, I can't manipulate this world. It doesn't make any sense. This world is unfair.
Yeah. Right. And that would be like the problematic part of cheating. As soon as you start doing these and undercutting people's expectations, you ruin their ability to anticipate, plan. And like you say, they check out. What is there to know about this game that they can't just get just letting you tell it?
Yeah. Well, but
oh, go ahead.
But again, I think we go back to an earlier episode where you talk basically talking about the story that the GM wants to tell and has the expectation where here's the script, you got to guess what we're saying, right? And hopefully, and that's why the princess with the 20 wolf warriors show up, because you'd ruin his story. And, you know, I think we talk about it's like, well, it's not really your story. You're a player. Everybody has to make the story. Story emerges from what we're doing. Ergo, right. you're putting your own needs ahead of everyone else, and then when everybody else get upset, you're upset because everybody else is upset.
Right, and I wanted to add to that I realized after I said that, once again, that's a loaded statement because that's a formal way of playing. If it's a performative game where the players are we're told in advance their goal is to be entertaining and roll with stuff, that wouldn't be against the rules. The GM can do whatever they want if they think it makes good theater because they're the director and they're in charge. And so a performative player here who wants to roll with it and improv and try to be entertaining based off of this, they're not as concerned with when they leveled up, they made these choices. And they're also not concerned whether they live or die because they trust the director to get them in and out of it. Like this right here, we're talking about right now related to this cheating thing. This is where the Mercer effect happens. Players in a performative game don't complain because this isn't rule breaking to them. This is, oh, I guess the director went in a really weird direction. Well, we're still rolling, right? And so they roll with it, and they go back to their be entertaining, no dead air, you know, build up, improv, and those are their core rules. So to them, no rules have been broken.
Right, and because it's like in this improv impression, it does get to the point where we've said before, so wait, what's the rule book for then? And that's more like as a framing device at that point than anything of like telling you how you're going to actually play.
Right, and one of my issues here is that a performative game does have rule. Actors and such have been trained before they show up, and they have debriefing, and the session zero, they work with the director. They already set up those rules. So the rule book for a performative game would, and there are games out there that are designed even more formative. Fiasco, I think, is the go-to standard for that, where Fiasco explains, okay, something horrible is going to happen to you, but what? And talks you through the process of having fun, improving horrible things happening to you. It knows what it is, and then it is that. to a lesser extent, the paranoia role-playing game. They tell you up front, this game is unfair and horrible things are going to happen. Roll with it. And those games work because they told you everything is unfair or random or arbitrary in the first place. But if you pick up a copy of like Dungeons & Dragons, they never say anything like that in there. They say the opposite of that. They say, do what you want. Make the character who matters to you. Here are choices at every level of creation. Everything is permitted. You know, like no matter how weird this is. Gnomes, play a gnome. It's right here. You know, write down that you're a badger, but you were actually a gnome. You
a donkey on the keyboard sheet.
Yeah. Do whatever you want. And which is, you know, as we all agree, no, you can't do whatever you want. There will be written rules and unwritten.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And go ahead.
Oh, I was about to say, Red, you've been awfully silent. What are your kind of thoughts on all this?
Sorry, guys. Yeah. No, I think that you guys have raised a lot of really strong points, and I agree with many of them. And I guess I'm trying to think for the sake of variety, like, when is it okay? Because, I mean, lessons brought up right at the beginning that sometimes you've got to cheat. You've got to fudge the rules. Get out of here.
To help you formalize that, give us an example of like when you've cheated. Tell us your dirty cheating tale.
My dirty cheating secrets? Yes. Live on air?
Exactly.
Oh, geez. While I wrestle with a cat. Cat, you've got impeccable timing. Get down. Get down. Thank you. I think the last time we had this discussion or touched on this discussion, right, I confessed to... occasionally I will. Oh my goodness. Can you guys see this cat? I'm so sorry. Can you get back to me in 1 second? Or maybe she's
cat okay. is the real cast member here.
No, yeah, you have to, yeah. you have to no, distract no. them. Otherwise, I'll have to tell everybody how I've been cheating.
Okay, no. All right, we're doing this. We're going live.
It's been a dirty, like, since we started streaming like many years ago, I think it's been like 10 years. I've been waiting for somebody to call me out on it because there are times. that I am blatantly cheating when I'm a GM, right there on the numbers. And I'm amazed that some of you have never caught me. And now that I say this out loud, you know, like, I'm worried that one...
Well, I haven't cheated as of late, because I try very hard not to. In fact, what I tend to do is go at the rule book, going like, okay, what do the rule says that I can do, right? Because the one thing you can do, and this is started really with third edition, fourth edition, you can make your own monsters, right? That's implied that you can make your own monsters
in any version of the game.
True. And so what I've done is like, well, what if I, by the rules, I give them a spell and ability that makes it not impossible to be seen by the person who can see almost anything, but possible, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't cheated because it's a spell there. But yeah. Again, cheating is... It's not simply a matter of actually cheating, but also the perception of cheating.
Well,
someone who has made a character like that is like, well, I should be able to see them, but you can't. Right? And I'm not going to tell them, by the way, I use this spell, right?
I talk about checking out. Like, giving spell-like ability to a monster that normally doesn't have it and have it casting the spell in secret and having all that stuff happen is exactly the same as something happened and I didn't understand it. Because the best things that happen in games are known unknowns. There's a difference between we ambushed a bunch of kobolds and one of them had spellcasting abilities because kobolds are natural spellcasters. It says that in the book. So, you know, we should know they might be able to do that. We might, you know, any humanoid can be a spellcaster. The one I always point to is, oh my God, or like the cheating but not cheating. Like, for example, Forgotten Realms. Forgotten Realms has a gazillion kinds of golems in it. There are golems that can shapeshift. There are golems that can teleport. There are golems that can hold conversations with you because they, you know, they can pretend, they're basically doppelgangers. They pretend to be people. There's a gazillion of them because golems are magical constructs and magic can do anything in D&D. And so you could throw a golem at me in a Forgotten Realms game and have it do anything you want it. We're kind of getting out of the realm of cheating here of kind of like, you know, that like I said, that's just checking out. It's like, yeah, the universe is possible. I
wouldn't consider that cheating.
Well, right. I mean, that's a different debate of this universe makes no sense. So I'm not even going to try.
So I think I definitely got a little bit of a, here's my dirty cheating secret. So, I'm running like a Pathfinder game. And one of the things I'm pretty frequently doing at this point is just letting people cast NPCs cast their spells for battle preparation ahead of time without like any check, without figuring out what they're doing, or even like if they get surprised, they just already have it. Mostly just because they will never get the chance to cast anything in combat because battle will be done in three rounds. They'll never get it off.
I'm right there with you, actually.
Yeah. I mentioned the rune quest. Right?
The what?
The rune quest.
The rune quest. Rune quest, one of the long running competitors to D&D. There's an NPC that it's written in his description that he has the ability of precognition. He always knows four rounds before a battle starts, so he always casts these specific four buffing spells before it starts. See, that's not cheating. We made up a rule that this guy has a unique ability mentioned never before in the rule book and never afterwards that allows him to do it.
I was watching stuff recently, and there's a word for it, but I forget what it is, but it's when within a story... people try to justify things happening in universe where it's really like, no, the author wrote that in. They had control of the story. They shouldn't have done it.
No, there's two words for that. There's retroactive continuity or retconning when something we thought was true turns out to be false. And there's backfill where we make up an excuse for why this happened.
Yeah,
very much so.
But Devin, I want to ask you a question because this goes to cheating, whether it's a cheat or not. Did you at any time tell your players that if they were quiet and stealthy, they could get the drop on their enemies? Or it was assumed that if they go noisy and standard adventuring, we're just going to kill everything, that the people down the hall wouldn't hear what was coming and would not prepare otherwise?
You see, this is the difference between you and me, because I assume that all players are always acting to their maximum personal advantage at all times, which is an official rule in Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition, I might add. Because if you assume that your player... See, but this gets into different GMing styles. If you assume your players are incompetent and are just jokes, which might be, you know, the paranoia method of playing. Some people might...
Well, I'm not saying they're incompetent. There's just a different attitude. It's like, if you know, you're a well-armed group of enemies with heavy armor and weapons and magic, why would you sneak around if you can just blast your way through everything, right? It's not incompetent, but it works.
I have actually like three answers and three scenarios. The first is, yeah, of course the players are trying to be sneaky, and usually they'll like announce it because they're suddenly paranoid and they want to do really well, and rewarding them for that is good. The second scenario is they just plain forgot and they weren't even thinking about it because they were just having a good time. And the third one is, well, they literally just had a fight 20 feet away. I think they heard it coming.
Right. But I mean, I'm going from the angle of, I'm sorry, have you met a player who isn't constantly describing everything for maximum advantage?
Right. And then that comes down definitely to the how do players spot traps dilemma, because there's not really a set of formal rules of how to structure that interaction. So really what you have to do is assume players are always looking for traps, because it would be terrible if they stepped in one. When they get close to triggering one, have them roll.
Well, if you...
Otherwise, they'll never get the roll, they'll fall into it, they'll feel completely betrayed, and they'll check out.
If you go back to D&D 1st Edition, they mentioned you only move 120 feet every hour.
Yikes, yeah.
I've asked people to contemplate that. Like, that's slower than forensic pathologists. So you're only moving 120 feet every hour, and you're still not finding the secret doors and traps. You're that bad at your job.
Yeah, the mechanical reason behind that is because the alternative, it's actually probably the best case if they check out, because the alternative is then you have players who feel that it is necessary to narrate every minute that they are... Mm-hmm. checking for traps, or that they have their, you know, it's the classic,
it becomes you tiresome.
Hear something. Yeah, it becomes tiresome. It's the like, ooh, you hear a twig snap, you think you might be ambushed, what do? Well, I draw my weapon, and it's like, everybody, I don't know, for the next 100 feet, I make sure that I approach warily and with my weapon drawn. And it's like, oh, Jesus, okay.
Yeah, we get crap for this in Ironclaw, because Ironclaw assumes you don't have your weapons out all the time, because we assume you're not carrying a 7-pound rusty sword in your hand. And so the initiative roll in Ironclaw was to roll to see if you even had your weapons out in the first place. And that drives players nuts. Because of course my weapons are ready at all times. Of course I've been walking for 5 hours in the wilderness with trees and bushes in my way with a non-stainless steel sword out in the elements in the dew the entire time.
I gotta tell you, I went to do LARPs. We have like foam swords. They're like 1 pound at like tops. You get tired of doing that after 20 minutes.
I buy that.
If you can put it away, you put it away.
I think it's passable because it's codified. I think the reason that it becomes a big issue in 5e or in a lot of these games is because that is one of the areas where people don't want to have to think about the rules, right? They don't want to have to consider the tangibility of all of this stuff. So it's hand-waved. But then why wouldn't they just have it out, right? And because you've made it non-explicit, you get into situations where people say, well, of course I had my sword out, or I would have been prepared since entering the dungeon. I always carry my two sickles at the ready whenever I'm in a dungeon.
Which leads, we're discussing things like we're all agreeing, if we knew it in advance, it wouldn't feel like a cheat. Like, if there was just a formal rule in the game that when you rolled your initiative, you know, if you rolled like 15 or better or whatever, let each player who has a buffing spell can cast one buffing spell before the play begins, or choose one buff before the play, you know, before the battle even begins, players would immediately wrap their brains around that. And no one would complain that it was unfair, but the rules aren't written the way. I mean, the major reason why I think in the comments that people come up with is the reason why the GMs cheat is because the rules don't have provisions for what they want. But the opposite to this is the reason why we have rules is so players will know what's going on. So the last question is, why aren't the rules matching what we're doing? Why do we have to cheat?
Mm-hmm. I never actually confessed my cheat, but I think it actually plays in here because what we're talking about here is when the rules are getting in the way and the GM specifically needs to circumvent them to help the game work for what the players want to do, for what the GM wants to do. I think that's going to be very subjective. Like, whether or not that's valid is going to depend exactly on what the players and the GM are trying to do, and maybe, you know, the restrictions of the game that they're trying to do it in. But the indefensible thing that I will cop to is that when I picked up 5e on my first campaign at my local game store, I was playing with a bunch of people who liked D&D, but maybe were coming back to it after a long time, or were very interested in like a performative play style. And I didn't know my ass from my elbow in terms of the system yet. And so I would get them into situations where there were combats that were just unbalanced, where there were just unfair situations or circumstances that blindsided me completely. And these are simple things like, oh, you know, this character, you're fighting a bunch of flying enemies and you've got no ranged attacks. Or, oh, you're fighting an invisible enemy, or you're fighting an enemy that, you know, will turn you to stone or something, but you have absolutely no provisions for dealing with that. And it got into situations where I realized, like, I'm about to ruin everyone's day within like 10 minutes of starting this game. And so I did fudge rolls. At this time, we were not rolling out in the open. In fact, with that group, I tried rolling out in the open at one point, and people reacted badly to it. They didn't want to know.
That's bizarre right there.
In fact, you're hitting what I was going to describe, which is, okay, so the trick behind cheating as a GM is, first of all, we all agree that only the GM is allowed to cheat, which, by the way, is a whole big can of worms.
What you want to do is put your D6 in the microwave for like 5 seconds at a time until it develops like a little bit of a... Yeah.
Okay, right, because we all agree that only the GM is allowed to cheat, not the players. But it's also when the GM cheats to lose, because I've been always commenting about playing to lose, because players only throw a fit when something they thought was going to work doesn't. Like, they got surprised when they shouldn't have. This monster has a special ability, it shouldn't, or this monster didn't die when I hit it. But if you flip that around and like, yeah, the monster's dead. It's like, really? I thought like ogres had like 80 hit points. We only did like 20. Nope, it's dead. It must have rolled low. When you cheat in the player's favor, they almost never give you crap about that. I must be great. Yes.
And so, it plays into cheating so that people are having fun is usually good cheating, because that's what everyone there is at the table for.
Right, and most players, we've got data lurking in the wings. Most players have, you know, fun when they're winning. And so it's a novice GM mistake. You know, like I always say, there's no bad games. There's just games that don't have players showing up. There will be GMs who make NPCs and my story is so cool. My characters are so cool and my characters can't be defeated so easily. So I'm going to make up reasons why they succeed. And some of those GMs will be tempted to cheat. And like I said, those usually don't have players. Either their entire squad quits or they're paying everyone to show up on Dimension 20 or something like that.
Yeah. No.
No offense to your favorite stream show.
Yeah. I think it, one of the things.
A purpose.
Yeah. Talking about going back to Session Zero, it's setting things like what are the overall win and lose conditions, right? Is your character can die? Because one of the things I also feel, and again, this might be someone else, it's like I feel that sometimes GMs who don't want to kill your character end up also losing players, at least losing me, because I feel that I don't get the sweet release of death for my character. Meaning, I have to endure whatever the GM gives me through this character because they're having a good time, but I'm not having a good time going through the ringer and feeling like I'm always almost about to win, but never really do because they always have something new to me to throw up with. It's like, well, what if I change my character or my character dies? And again, this one GM that I don't play with anymore, it's like, no, you cannot die. I don't kill my players. It's like, so I'm here for your entertainment. But not
that's
mine.
Pretty funny, actually.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that situation, yeah. Escape.
Yeah, and I've already expressed an issue with a lot of gaming is still built on the old foundations of it's still a roguelike permadeath situation where you're supposed to randomly assess threats and some of them will kill you or you're supposed to run away. But no one knows that anymore because verbally they'll tell you, oh, it's all about, you know, having fun and expressing yourself. And the computer games say, die as much as you want. All that happens is you lose 10% of your equipment durability.
Mm-hmm. Die as much as you want. Hit quick load.
Yeah, just quick load.
Just see what happens when you do it. It's fun. Experiment because you bought the thing.
Or as I'm fond of saying, like, you know, Dark Souls, it's such a difficult game. You have infinite lives, and every time you die, you keep all your equipment in progress.
Well, I mean, it's more, it can be frustrating than difficult. And I think that's another thing. It's frustrating. We're talking about,
I'm comparing this to like other games I played before this, which is like, really?
Yeah. But yeah, I think that's one thing about fun, right? About fun and engagement. It's that we tend to cheat because the ultimate anti-frustration rule. But cheating can also be the ultimate frustrating, right? People check out and even leave. Thank you, Red. Because just a joke. Because you know they feel again it's unfair. So it's like if you don't cheat for the players when they feel that they should be cheated on, they feel it's unfair. Mm-hmm. And if you cheat them when they don't expect it, they also feel that's unfair. So the rule seems to be don't cheat. But we also, this guy I mentioned earlier, sometimes you got to just backfield something. You got to write on something.
I don't want to toot my own horn, but I'm flattered that people have figured out the last 10 years all the times I've cheated. So,
well, I haven't played with you as a GM, so I don't have experience.
Okay,
there,
but
so.
No, but like I'm waiting for Theta to go through the, you know, our producer here to go through all the records to go, wait, when did he? You know, was that a mistake or what did he do? You know, and it's really hard. And it always fascinates me how stuff like Roll 20 or the clients that you use to host these video games, host these role playing games online, don't have tools for cheating. Like if you roll, they'll always show you the genuine roll. If you want to roll in secret, it's so much more difficult than rolling obviously.
You can do it pretty easily and do it in secret. And I've seen a number of people lately using it far more aggressively, probably.
Right. But I think it's funny that it's kind of like, you know, like of course the people who implemented it took it literally. Why would anyone do this?
But the thing is, for example, you told Roll 20 with 5th edition, it actually has one we call pro cheat rule. Well, not really cheating, because it's in the rules. You can make your own NPCs and you can make your own monsters. So if I make a monster that says it's invulnerable to ice attacks, I can do that. And even if it's
not. Right, but that gets into the issue of I'm not cheating. I'm allowed to do anything I want. And that's kind of like, you know.
I don't think that is cheating. I think if you're working within the construct of the rules, then that's fine. I don't think there's any reason why you can't give your kobold a magical item, because kobolds have stat blocks and magical items have effects that are represented in the game.
But I do know what cheating is. They get in one of magic missiles, but the moment the player gets in the hand, it's ran out of, automatically ran out of target. I've seen it happen many times.
And I just want to say, you are technically correct. If there's a rule, and if there's a catch 22 rule in the book that says I can do whatever I want, then you're technically not cheating, because there's a rule that says you as the GM can do anything at any time.
Exactly.
That's why I wanted to roll this back a little bit and say, when we talk about cheating, we're talking about making fiat decisions that make you lose the confidence of the players. Like if you fudge a die roll to make a villain hit when they should have missed, or to give them more hit points when they shouldn't have those hit points, and the players figure out that you like fudged this number, or like you said, I just made this number impossibly high. This kobold went through a wild magic field and managed to gain magic resistance at a huge level. He ignores the first 3 saving throws, but you ignored 4. Sorry, he ignores the first 6 saving throws. I mean, I can sit here and make up stuff all day from stuff I know and justify it using...
Right, and from the position of the GM, you can infinitely cheat as much as you want. At any moment, you could just say, yeah, all the players, like, die. Why? Well, because you had an insidious disease, which you had no chance of identifying. You're all just dead. Campaign's over.
Did I mention I'm all everybody dies. Goddess of magic? You know? Yeah.
So, I guess I like that because at least it gives us a parameter that... Okay, these rules are fungible, might not be an actual word that I can use there because I don't know if it's the right word, but these rules are plastic. You can mess with them so long as you're not giving your players the feeling that they are being betrayed or lied to. So long as you can keep the veil up.
You know, if you follow the basic agreement of the group or the conversation, right? The thing that everybody agrees on, right?
And if your GM cheats to ruin the experience, just throw paper at him until he stops.
Yeah, and the thing I'm always getting at is...
Stop showing up to the game.
We say, not showing up, but we say that out loud, that like, oh, these rules, you know, can be manipulated. But the experience that the game designers sell you, I mean, I'm sitting here in the game designer seat, is when they, you know, they say, you can change these rules to be whatever you want. By the way, here's the complete Marshall Handbook. You know, here's a new rule book that we're selling you that has rules already in it. Well, why did I buy a new rule book when I could have just made up anything I wanted? Why do they keep coming out with new player materials and that sort of thing? Why do I have to follow your stupid level 1 through 20, you know, schism or whatever, you know, this whole scheme that you want me to go through? And it's like, well, because at some level we need to have some sort of consistency and agreement. And if you cheat too much, if you fudge that too much, formal players will lose confidence and leave because nothing makes any sense anymore. If you're running a more performative game where you tell the player you're supposed to roll with stuff, that's fine, but your performative players will also lose interest in the formality. That's something I always want to express about. If it's going to be an improv game, we do wacky stuff wherever we want, then you're going to get players who do wacky stuff and whatever they want and do not care about your rules.
Yes. They'll roll for a thing and then, you know, regardless of the outcome, do what they were planning to do anyway, because the role is performative at that point as well.
Right. And they won't be impressed by your, in fact, that's the opposite. They're not going to be impressed by, you know, hey, I've got 30 pages that explain where this certain cursed group of kobolds and their wild magic came from. It's like, they don't care. Like that makes people enjoy your show more too. But I mean, like we all pretty much agree that if you're going to cheat, like if you're going to fudge numbers and fudge that kind of stuff, you should be doing it to make the game more fun, which usually means either to let the players win or, and this is the thing we haven't mentioned yet, or God forbid, make the fight early.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other one that I'm still guilty of, but I don't care because oftentimes you need to.
Gosh.
If the difference is 3 hit points between this combat going another 10 minutes or ending right now, when it's a foregone conclusion at this point, then it's just, hey, this guy didn't eat breakfast. I guess he's got 3
left people
points.
Are left alive and they just witnessed 15 other people die within 12 seconds. I think it's fine if they just surrender. I don't care what the rules are. They're done with this.
As much as I'm flattered that you say Iron Claw is a great game, it's a weakness of games like Iron Claw or 13th Age or D&D 4, because I've had, you know, GMs point out that because it's got tightly written rules that we're designed to respect, it's more difficult to fudge those because people are paying attention. Yeah. It attracts the kind of people who are paying attention to those rules and get upset if they're fudged. And that would be a legitimate criticism if, you know, you want to play a much more loose game. I mean, it's the weird thing people praise about D&D 5. It's easier to cheat in D&D 5.
Yeah, there's less interconnectivity. This also dovetails, and I know we're running long on time. So, but I did want to say one more thing that I think has not been mentioned and is, and I think should be in this conversation, which is that there is also this like lies getting out of hands quality to it. When I was fudging things, I found it easier and easier to fudge more and more things, but I also felt my grip on the game loosening in a very serious way. Kind of what I guess we were talking about with, like, you know, as performative play, your players are going to care less about the formal rules the more that you break those formal rules. But for my own peace of mind as well, I got to places where it was kind of like, eh, why am I bothering to prep so much? Why do I care so much about all of these character stat blocks? If at the end of the day, if it's too difficult, I'm just going to lie. Or if it's too easy, I'm going to lie, right?
I'm there with you too, honestly. Like, I play like a lot of campaigns and I've run a lot. And after a certain point where I've done a lot of prepping, but I've done a lot of improv too in order to keep things going. It becomes harder to sort of build upon that because it's all an incredibly flimsy structure in the first place.
Well, the way I see it is my prep is not prepping a full-on story early, although I do write backstory and motivations and all that.
Oh, yeah, but I've given up on writing paragraphs of this.
Yeah. I do toolkits where what I bring to the table is my tool, and I start playing and things happen. It's like, okay, let me grab, I need a tough encounter. Okay, here comes the ogre. Boom. But I have it in my toolkit.
Yeah.
Right. Instead of being good. Yeah. And that I can kind of prevents a little bit the cheating because you would, in your mind, you already have a series you can always fall back into. Yeah. And it's better to have more, you know, rules based, both rules as the table and rules as written, rather than having, I got to pull something out of ether because this fight is too hard or too easy or whatever, you know, whatever situation might be. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and jump some concluding.
Well, I mean, I want to build on that real quick, but by mentioning that I will say that the one big problem is that people over-prepare. I mean, if you look in some of the liner notes of our games, we said, okay, look, just decide a general power level of the villains and what their motivations and resources are. And then when stuff comes up, improvise. And I have discovered GM's heads blow up. I don't know how your game works. I don't know how to improvise. I don't know what power levels are. You have to tell me. And it's like, but then on the other hand, if we give them exact power levels, we'll run into the opposite problem where numbers will show up. The GMs will go, sorry, I killed your entire party, guys. I just played the numbers that were written here. I didn't know you were all incredibly incompetent at fighting.
There's like a whole brand of cheating right there, actually. I didn't write it down, but he actually owns a car, too.
Well, and that gets into the retcon and backfill things that we were talking about. And that's why I keep talking about performative play as opposed to formalized play. A formalized play would be, this is the dungeon, and here's everybody listed and what their stats are. A more story-written game would be, you know, once again, like, we're not surprised at this. Like, for example, kobolds are notorious for being wizard, you know, in D&D, are notorious for being both blood sorcerers and good at traps. So if I wander, you know, if the kobolds run off and I run after them and set off 9 deadfalls in a row, you know, everyone would say, did you know that kobolds are good at traps? And we'd be done. You know, that wouldn't be cheating, even if the module didn't specify that, because in set up earlier, and this is a payoff. It's, it's the danger, I think, of but what I'm mad at with D&D is the danger of there's so much set up in advance. Wild magic can do anything. Chaos, gods, intervention, undead. That anything becomes possible that, you know, then the game doesn't, you know, it becomes more of a comedy type game, which once again can be fun for your players. But like I said, like when we're talking about cheating, the best, we go back to what we said earlier, the best cheating is when they don't know. Like if you run after the kobold and they, like I said, set off all those traps, it's like, you know, I don't know if that was there or not, because that's something that makes a lot of sense in the story. If suddenly you reveal that the kobold had wild magic and has a staff of wizardry and suddenly unleashes a portal that makes a mesodemon come out, I would be scratching my head going, yeah, I'm pretty sure you could justify that, but I'm pretty sure you pulled that out of your butt. And
teleports away, and there's no way for you to track him, and he's gone, by the way.
Even if you have a legitimate, this gets into the opposite problem we're having. If you're going to cheat, you're supposed to cheat to make the game more fun, not go through a book and find one obscure rule about teleport without error and throw that in your players' faces. Aha, they just got away. You know, because that's, even if that's legit or not, it still feels like a cheat.
And that's how I learned to hate the game. So let's go ahead and get some concluding statements on cheating. Lessons, what do you got?
Well, I'm just going to repeat what I've been saying a couple of times throughout the episode, that it's ultimately it's about that sort of bargain that all the players, including the GM, make when as they play, either session zero or early on, or develops as a group over time. If you go beyond that, it's always going to feel like cheating. If you're within the boundaries, no matter how wild it might seem, it'll feel fine, either because it's performative or et cetera, because those ultimately, that's the one rule that matters, that we all agree on what the themes, ideas, and outer limits of this particular game are, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what really defends cheating. Is more of a, I mean, you can literally cheat, of course, but more of one of feeling cheated rather than any actual cheat.
Yeah. What about you, Red?
I think we opened up a can of worms there, but I like it. I like the idea that a lot of the kind of cheating that I'm talking about is something that can, it's replacing a lack of system mastery, that as you get more comfortable with the game itself and how to prep for it and how to run it, that hopefully you have to rely less on those kinds of cheats. But I did want to add that I think there is one other danger to that kind of cheating, which is, as I think that, like, in the same way that a player can feel really good when their character build works and the trick is pulled off and they beat a, you know, big bad monster with this specific thing, you can feel very fulfilled and satisfied. I think as a GM, I get that oftentimes when I see the rules of the game work the way I feel like they're intended to create good situations, especially within the context of how I've manipulated them or included them or planned to incorporate them into the game session. And I think that cheating, messing with those numbers, it cheapens that kind of joy for me, which is why it's something that I specifically want to get away from. And I think if you're that kind of GM and your games are not feeling as satisfying as you think they should be, maybe that could be a leading cause for it, or that could be a contributing factor. Just something I was thinking about while we were talking. That's what I'll go out on.
And Rafferty, what do you think?
Yeah, well, when we started all this, as I wanted to find, every role-playing game ever written, save one, has said that the GM can do whatever the hell they want. So technically, there's no cheating. But someone feels cheated when they expected something to work a certain way and it didn't. So the real key to being a successful host for a game is to not let players feel cheated. If you're going to bend things or twist them a little bit, it doesn't matter if it's written down in a book or if some other precedent had it, or you're just like rolled a one and saying it's a 19. If the players feel cheated by the experience, that's always bad. And different groups will have different boundaries or levels of skill. Like has come up here, sometimes, you know, a GM's, sometimes a host of the game will feel that they are inexperienced, so they will instead fudge the results or use fiat to overrule, you know, or make, you know, like what a book might actually say to do, citing that. And that can build up toxicity very quickly, because each player will often have one rule they've memorized. You know, like, I know it's tough. The host has to memorize everything, but, you know, the one warlock player will have memorized that one warlock paragraph. And if you remove the way that works, they'll feel cheated. So, like, as we all agreed, in order to avoid make players feel cheated, you need to learn how to play to lose, which I think is another subject we've talked about before. It's like, read the room and make it more fun for the players that are there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And just go ahead and top it all off. You want to make sure when they're in the microwave, the side you want is actually facing up, and you only want a couple seconds at a time. Otherwise, it gets obvious. But that's going to be all for Notes from the Aleph. So we stream episodes bi-weekly Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern, and you can join us live on twitch.tv/Raktus. We also stream and record weekly tabletop games on the same channel, and you can come join us and whenever we start at 10 a.m., 2 p.m., and 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Sundays and Wednesdays. Norman Rafferty here is a partner and writer for Sanguine Games. Check out sanguinegames.com, join us on Reddit or Twitter, and look forward to the upcoming Book of Quarrels. And for Lessons Learned, don't forget to check out his channel, Lesson Learned 1, on Twitch and YouTube, where he has a number of series going on, and check him out on Amazon, too, as well, for all of his fun books. And for Red Rabbit, don't forget to check him out over at startplayinggames.com as Red Rabbit. And be sure to like, comment, and subscribe, and come see us all again. Until next time.
How to ruin your game and potentially your microwave.